Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. And today we kick off the week with a topic that, next to life and death, is about the most important one I think most people can imagine right now. The global economic crisis that really has swept the entire world like a global tsunami. I like to think of it as a growing economic holocaust, with the damage it's inflicting and who knows how much it will inflict before this runs its course. And make no mistake about it, this has a long, long, long way to run. I've written plenty about it, but not with the expertise of my guest this morning, and I'm so delighted to have Ellen Brown back on the program. And Ellen is a civil litigation attorney, but she has incredible expertise on this topic, and she writes incredible articles, including the one that we'll discuss a good bit this morning. But Ellen is an attorney. She's an author. She's a frequent writer on financial topics. She has written, numerous books. An extremely important one is called Web of Debt, and she analyzes the private cartel Federal Reserve and how it usurped the money creation power of the country to control it, its price, so on and so forth, to create the absolute mess that we're in right now. She writes often on topics related to the global crisis, and her latest article is called Playing the Banking Game, How Cash-Starved States Can Create Their Own Credit. Anybody know that? Well, I didn't until I read Ellen's article. And it's posted, I believe, on numerous websites. It's up on globalresearch.ca that brings you this program every day, Monday through Friday. It was posted early in March. And again, playing the banking game. Ellen, I welcome you to the program.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be on your program.
Oh, happy daylight saving time. It completely blindsided me over the weekend. Somebody mentioned it to me, but I completely forgot. And when I spotted the time, I thought my cable box clock was absolutely wrong. It went haywire. It said it was an hour later than it really was, but it was right and I was wrong. So I began my Sunday an hour late. But we have a crucial topic to discuss, Ellen. It certainly is a major, major crisis. And economists like Michael Hudson, who's been on this program, has referred to what's going on as literally a coup d'etat. And I really agree with that, that the criminal bankers in Wall Street have really pulled this off. And now the criminals are being rewarded by looting the national wealth to bail them out. And you propose in your article that the states opt out of this system and go to a state-owned banking system. What a wonderful way to stick it right to these guys and literally get out from under their clutches. We'll have a break in a minute or so, but let me let you start. When we hear the music, I'll interrupt, and then we'll come back, and you can pick it up.
Okay. I agree with Michael Hudson. And, you know, there was this $550 billion, the largest bank run in history on September 15th when $550 billion worth of money market funds were withdrawn from the banks when Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Oh, the beginning. Ellen, let me interrupt because they'll break away. But you pick it up as soon as we come back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Crisis and what we can do about it. Ellen, let me let you continue where you left off.
Sixth on C-SPAN of this year, Representative Paul Kanjorski said that the real reason for the $700 billion bailout, they were told in Congress that there had been a $550 billion run on the banks within the space of 2 hours when Lehman Brothers collapsed. That was on September 15th. And this was, they were told that this would, that the whole market would have collapsed or would collapse if they didn't rush to save the banks. This was like a shot across the bow. It was rather like, this is what will happen if you let any of our banks go bankrupt. The question is, how did they get $550 billion out so quickly? Was it a single hedge fund, a number of hedge funds? Was it program trading? I don't know. I'm still researching that, but it all looks very suspicious. You wouldn't think that it would have been that much that quick. But anyway, the interesting thing was they did not need to let Lehman Brothers collapse in the way they did. They could have done an orderly bankruptcy like they did with IndyMac, where the FDIC goes in and it sorts things out and it deals with the money market funds in whatever way. I mean, there's a way it could be done, I understand. So why did they let it just collapse in that way as a sort of, it was like a threat, it seems to me. Anyway, there's reason to feel that their whole modus operandi here is to extort these bailouts because we have to do it because otherwise we won't have a credit system. So my argument is that credit is merely something created on the books of banks in the first place, and there is no reason why we could not have public banks doing the same thing. They wouldn't have this problem of the derivatives messing up their books, and the interest would go back to the bank, which would be a public entity, and because it would be state-owned or municipal-owned, it would have control over what it set the interest rates at, et cetera. So there is some precedence for this. There's the Bank of North Dakota, the only state in the union that owns its own bank is North Dakota. 46 of 50 banks are bankrupt or insolvent anyway and may have to file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy within the next 2 years. One of the four that isn't insolvent is North Dakota, a strange fact considering that it's an isolated farming state in a cold area where not many people even want to live. Why are they doing so well when everybody else is going under? The reason seems to be that they have their own credit mechanism. They have their own bank. And it's not like that just means that they take the funds. Well, the way they operate the bank is that the state's revenues all go into the bank as a matter of law, and then they operate like an ordinary bank. But the secret is an ordinary bank operates by spanning its reserves or its assets into many times that sum in loans. And so the Bank of North Dakota can do the same thing, and it does give farmers loans at 1% interest. It gives student loans at very good rates, and it just has plenty of money for all its credit needs. It could, in theory, I'm saying, a state bank could, in theory, give itself loans at 0% interest and roll them over indefinitely. So it would be the same as issuing money. Of course, in our Constitution, there's a provision that states can't issue bills of credit, but there's nothing that says a state can't own its own bank and function just like any bank does, which is create credit on its books.
The way you wrote the article, Ellen, you laid it out so clearly and simply, and anybody reading your article, number one, would probably say, my goodness, I never knew that, and number two, this really is not complicated. It means opening a bank and functioning like any other bank, except in this case, the state does it. The state owns it. It can loan itself money alone and pay no interest. And why should it pay any interest? So it can save the taxpayers money, and it operates on the magic of fractional reserve banking. Explain that to listeners, Ellen.
Well, the fractional reserve system goes back to the 17th century when the bankers were the goldsmiths. People would bring their gold to the goldsmiths for safekeeping, and the goldsmiths started issuing these paper receipts called banknotes, which had their name on them. So they were privately issued paper receipts. And the people found that they preferred trading the little paper receipts to trading the gold, so the paper receipts actually became the money supply. And then other people would want to borrow gold, but they, too, preferred trading in these paper receipts to carrying this gold around, which is heavy, and they could get robbed and so forth. So the goldsmiths discovered that people only came for their gold about 10% of the time, and therefore they could issue 10 times as many paper receipts as they had gold. So it was basically a fraud. 90% of these paper receipts that they were issuing were not backed by anything, but they were all redeemable in gold. And that same system has been in effect for 300 years. It competed with the American system for at least 100 years. During the 18th century, the American colonists had their own money, paper money, which was government issued. And that's what most people think. We still think that the government issues our money, but that's not true. Our money is issued by the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation, and lent to the government. And even those Federal Reserve notes are only 3% of the money supply. 97% of the money supply is created by banks in the form of loans. And they use the same fractional reserve procedure where now what they have on reserve is not even gold. It's just promises to pay. But usually it's government securities, which are IOUs in the first place. So our own IOUs, our government's IOUs, are the basis for banks to create 10 times that many IOUs from the public, which bear interest, and with the interest goes back to the banks.
It really sounds so magical, Ellen, that the first time I read about fractional reserve banking, I said to myself, gee, this is really a terrific business. I really would love to set myself up as a bank, and for every buck I put in, like magic, I have 10. So, you know, I mean, just keep adding more money, and it multiplies by this magical thing called fractional reserve banking. And, I could be, 24 hours, I could be a millionaire.
Well, it does sound good, but, you know, the banks are in trouble for a real reason. It actually just doesn't work mathematically. They came up with that whole derivative scheme to try to keep – it's a Ponzi scheme because they continually have to suck in more borrowers than there are. I mean, they have to continually – they create the principal, but they don't create the interest necessary to pay off their loans. And so to find the interest, they have to find new borrowers because that's how money is made. They have to continually be creating new money in the form of credit just to keep this bubble going or this pyramid. So this in 300 years, this system has gone around the world, and it's indebted everybody. Third world, of course, we got, and then they came back and got us all excited about everybody should own his own home. And then they went through all the borrowers who could actually afford a home, and then they got into the subprime borrowers. I mean, they've had to do this to keep the whole bubble going. And then they to get subprime borrowers, they wouldn't actually want those dodgy loans on their books, so they moved them off their books by selling them to investors, packaging them up as securities, and to get the investors to buy them, they supposedly protected them with credit default swaps. They said, don't worry, we've sold off the risk to other investors. Well, that whole credit default swap scheme is what's collapsing because the problem was the parties on the other sides of these bets did not have the money to pay up. Nobody checked to make sure that they could actually pay as they would have if it was an actual insurance company. So the whole scheme has collapsed, it's because the bankers needed all that to keep that whole system going. You know, it didn't work for Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. You can't lend out other people's money. Well, the bankers are on the hook for coming up with all that money when people come to them to get it back. You know, a deposit, somebody just explained this to me where it says that it's a demand deposit. They're not really saying they've got the money. They're saying they'll come up with it when you demand it. So they're assuming you're only going to demand it 10% of the time. So if you demand it more than that, or if their 10% has shrunk because their capital is all frozen, as it is right now, then suddenly they don't have the money to pay out on claims. Basically,
if all depositors lined up at the same time and said, give me all my money, no bank could do it because they simply don't have that money on hand. Then they have to lock the door and close up. The problem that you're describing overall, the securitization problem, Ellen, the major banks, I just loosely like to call them Wall Street, Of course, they're all located in the big boys, or at least most of them are located there. And we know their names well. And they literally, in my mind, mostly stopped being bankers and started just operating like a casino, just a big gambling operation.
Right.
And I guess it all works well as long as it works well until it stops working well. And you talk about the parasite running out of its food source. Well, I mean, this giant Ponzi scheme, you can only keep this thing going so long, and eventually it's going to disintegrate under its own weight, and that's exactly what's happened over the past year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm. We're paying off those credit default swaps bit by bailing them out, but we the taxpayers can't possibly afford to bail out the whole $62 trillion credit default swap scheme or the $165 trillion in derivatives that are on the books of U.S. banks. So what they should do is stop it right now before all our taxpayer money is gone. But what they need to do is just void out those credit default swaps, you know, unwind them.
We need to take another break, Ellen. Let's do it, and we'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Let's go to the heart of the matter. Life Change Tea has had some commercials that are not appealing to those who live in denial. Maybe we are to believe there are no parasites in the world and that having a clogged colon is good for you. That being overweight is absolutely healthy. That there are no unhealthy chemicals in the air. And last but not least, fluoride in your water is good for you. Not. Get the tea. Change your body and life from unhealthy to healthy. Order online at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Or you can call us at 928-308-0408. That's 928-308-0408. Or order online at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Life Change Tea, the tea that changes how you feel.
To the News Hour. I'm on with Ellen Brown. We're talking about the economic crisis. Ellen, it seems so obvious, at least some of the things that should be done that aren't being done, but there's no doubt in my mind that they're doing what they're doing deliberately. And way back, I've written articles that went back to the 1980s, when at least from that time period, the national wealth from most of us began to be transferred to the wealthy elite in the country, roughly the top 1%. Alan Greenspan, before he became Fed chairman in 1987, was put in charge of fixing the Social Security system. It wasn't broken, but he was put in charge of fixing it anyway, and he concocted a scheme to raise the payroll tax for most of us, but of course put a cap on income. So people above a certain income level didn't pay anything on that higher income, only up to the amount of that cap. And I haven't paid any Social Security into the system because I'm on the system now as a retiree. But I think the cap is, what, about $100,000 in income now?
I don't know.
I think it's roughly about that. But back in the 1980s, it was a lot less than that. So high-income earners, CEOs making $1 million or $10 million, whatever, they didn't pay any payroll tax on that. But ordinary wage earners earning the going wages, or even good salaries back then, $50,000, $60,000, maybe I think the cap was below that in the 1980s. But they paid payroll tax on all or most of their income, and this was part of a plot to transfer our wealth to the rich elite in the country. And then we got into the more advanced schemes, Ellen, with the securitization racket and all the rest. I mean, these guys keep inventing new ways to steal the national wealth for themselves, and they're doing it right now, and I just look at it in general as kind of a scheme to take the money and run.
I agree. But another reason they're doing it, the reason they're desperately trying to keep this those big banks bailed out is, I would suspect, is the fear of prosecution. Because in the 1980s, when the savings and loans went bankrupt, they did just let them go through bankruptcy in the ordinary way, and people did go to jail. Because, you know, once the books are, the FDIC has them, then they pour over them and they can see exactly what they're up to. We don't even get an accounting of what they're doing with our bailout money, that, you know, the recent bailout money, let alone what they've done in the past 10 or 15 years. So I suspect that, you know, that's a serious motive on their part.
I think we could sum it up, Ellen, by saying these guys, should we name them, the Citigroups, the Bank of Americas, the Goldman Sachs people? I mean, these people have committed massive fraud, the greatest heist in world history. And in partnership, I don't call it a government, Ellen. I call it a crime syndicate in Washington. And it's no different under Obama than under Bush, except Obama seems to be giving away more than Bush ever did. I mean, in less than 2 months in office, trillions of dollars are being handed to these people through all sorts of schemes. Again, we don't even know. I've seen numbers, many weeks back, $9.5 trillion. And you know that Bloomberg sued to get the Fed to reveal who's getting this money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they can drag those suits out forever until maybe it doesn't make any difference. But we have a right to know. I mean, being handed to people and likely everybody getting the so-called bailout money, every bank likely is insolvent, but nobody wants to tell us who they are or the amounts that they're getting. And what really is important is what you say, to really unravel this massive fraud and hold the people who did this accountable. That's what really should be done, but probably never will be.
Yeah, and for AIG, the reason, you know, Ben Bernanke said he was as mad as anybody. He was, you know, really mad about that AIG situation, but we still had to bail them out because, well, who we were bailing out was not AIG, but the counterparties. Well, who are the counterparties? Those are still all the banks. And it seems to me, I mean, so some will be pension funds and so forth, but it seems to me that if you were the counterparty in a fraudulent financial product, as they say, the party that should be held liable is the party that put that financial product together, which would be the bank that wrote the thing. So it seems to me that all those victims would have claims against the banks themselves. Well, I mean, that will definitely bankrupt the banks, but they're the parties that should be taking the hit, not the pension funds or the people that innocently invested in these securities.
You know, it strikes me, Ellen, that we could go through a lot of pain if we did some of the right things, but it would be much more short-lived than if we keep doing the wrong ones. But, of course, ordinary people will be hurt the most.
Mm-hmm.
The government doesn't care about ordinary people. The language is absolutely deceptive. They don't care about us. How many millions will lose their homes, jobs? I've had economists on this program who said that since November, we're leeching maybe up to 1 million jobs a month, not the fictional numbers that the Department of Labor puts out. So even if Obama creates 3 million jobs or 4 million, whatever, my God, we lose that in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep losing them month after month.
And the reason that we're losing jobs, it has nothing to do with, I mean, we've got the workers, we've got the factories, we've got the resources that we ever had. It's just the lack of the medium of exchange. So that's why I'm arguing you could put in a public credit system and just get everything going again, and you can put all those people back to work.
Oh, indeed. We have to break again. And I would add, let's bury the zombie banks and be done with them. But we could talk more about that when we come back.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ellen Brown, talking about the global economic crisis. Oh, the credit problem, indeed, Ellen. Like the human body, it can be perfectly fine. All the working parts are there. But if you deprive it of blood through the veins or oxygen into the lungs, it completely breaks down and dies.
Mm-hmm.
And no credit, and the economy breaks down and dies. And these big banks that have gotten us into this mess. There's an article today on Global Research by Dave Lindorf called Kiss the Banks Goodbye. It's time to put a stop to this fuss. And he's talking about closing down the big banks. And these are the guys that caused the problem. You want to solve the problem? They're a cancer. We need to exercise that cancer and start the healing process going. But right now, of course, as you know, Ellen, so well, we just keep pouring more money down a black hole, giving it to these guys.
Mm-hmm. And, well, you wouldn't have to wipe those banks out either. You just put them into FDI receivership like they always do with bankrupt banks. The FDIC steps in and sorts out the assets, paying off the creditors according to what they have. They don't take money from the taxpayers. The trouble is what they're calling nationalization now. They're keeping the entity going as it is and trying to meet all those obligations to creditors. So the creditors are making out like bandits. They're not taking any haircut at all. And it's the taxpayers taking the haircut as the shareholders. If, you know, because we've moved into a shareholder position. But if the FDIC goes in as receiver, it just takes control and clears the books with the assets that are available in the bank. And then you start with a viable entity with a clean set of books. And then at that point, you nationalize it and while they get it back on its feet. And my argument would be you keep it once you've got it on its feet. Why are we the taxpayers taking all the hits and the risks and the cost, and then we turn it back to the same people or the same types of people that gambled the thing away in the first place? Why don't we keep it as a public credit machine? And since those big banks have branches everywhere, we would virtually have our public credit system right there just by taking over the three top big banks.
Well, I like your idea very much. The private giant banking system, Ellen, has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that leave things in their hands and they will absolutely muck it up so badly that if we let them go back and have another round of doing this, if somehow miraculously they go back to good health, how they could do that, I have no idea, but let's assume they do. They'll figure out a way to create another problem, likely even greater than the one we have now, and they'll keep doing it until they destroy everything. I like the idea of putting it into permanent receivership, making the big banking system a public utility.
Exactly.
And combining it with local banking so that you and I can do all of our banking on a local level. We don't have to worry about what goes on in some other state. I wish every state would have a state-owned bank like North Dakota has, and we could keep it simple, local, and out of the hands of big predators.
Cities could do the same thing. The city of Newark has its own bank, and I just heard that on a my comedy show, I forget what, that they've got $1 million in assets and they're fanning it into $6 million in credit, which they're using to get businesses in the city going.
So a city can do it the same way as a state can do it then?
Any government entity with assets could put all those assets in a bank and then fan them into that many, you know, 10 times that sum or whatever in loans. And the Federal Reserve itself, let's assume we nationalize the Federal Reserve, or even leaving it private, make the Federal Reserve use that $700 billion bailout as the reserves for credit that will be issued for the public, not to their private banks. You know, they just wrote $1.2 trillion on their books that they just created out of nothing. Always before, the Federal Reserve's assets have been government securities, you know, that they traded for our dollars, and they stayed about the same. They were $800 billion in about a year ago, well, 2 years ago, and then the government securities dropped in half, but they still said they had, well, I guess it was by then, $850 billion on their books because they were counting the loans that they had made with the securities. They had traded the securities for dodgy collateral from the banks, but they were counting that on their books as assets. So always it has stayed about the same. But then this last year, suddenly, they had $2.1 trillion on their books. There was an extra $1.2 trillion. And what they were counting was loans that they had made to private banks, private credit card companies, and private corporations. They're not making the loans to us, the government, you know, us, the public. So, although they could, and the thing about the Federal Reserve is when they lend money to the government, they rebate the interest after they deduct their costs. They haven't always, but in the 60s, Wright Patman was head of the House Banking and Currency Committee, and he was looking into the Federal Reserve, and he was shocked at how they operated, and he was trying to get them nationalized, get the Federal Reserve nationalized. Well, that didn't happen. But what he did succeed in doing was getting them to rebate the interest after deducting their costs. So that means it's almost interest-free money to the government, and the government never pays off its federal debt. It always just rolls it over. Unlike a state bank, which has to balance its books, the government's allowed to just go into debt and go into debt. So if you roll these loans over indefinitely and they're interest-free, that's the same as government-issued money, which is what they did in the 18th century, and it worked really well. So that's another. So you could have a state level. You could work that on the state level, at a federal level, at a city level. So there are several different ways you could reach the same result of replacing the private banking system with the public banking system.
I think whatever system was set up earlier, Ellen, to make the Fed rebate interest back to the federal government, I'll bet you that disappeared sometime between the emergence of Ronald Reagan and today.
Well, no, they reported that just this last year that they rebated all but 15%. So
as far as you know, they may still be rebating interest to the government?
They say on their website that they do, and they said in the last year they rebated 85% of what they got.
Well, of course,
they claim to be nonprofit, but of course they don't count the fact that they pay their shareholders, who are all the member banks, 6% guaranteed interest every year, and 6% on their investment, whatever that was, and they take all their costs out, which I'm sure they live well on their payroll and so forth. But anyway, in order to purport to be a nonprofit, they have to return the excess interest.
I honestly believe that we need to abolish the Federal Reserve, at least to conform to the Constitution that says no private bank can create money in the country. Only the Congress has the power to coin money. Well, you know, if you want to give it to a private bank, then have an amendment to the Constitution, have it out in the open, and have it ratified by the states. I mean, that's the way the law is supposed to work in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't do things that way.
They actually need to rewrite the Constitution because it's so vague. It says Congress shall have the power to coin money. Well, there's no discussion of electronic money or, you know, all the money that we use today is just not even in there. And apparently they purposely left it out because they couldn't agree on whether to let Congress issue paper money after they'd had this bad experience of the Continentals, which was actually not the fault of the Continental. It was because the British heavily counterfeited it and because it had to compete with other currencies in the same way that third world currencies can be trashed by speculators. The Continental was trashed by speculators. But anyway, they were afraid of paper money, and so they just left it out. There were riots outside the Constitutional Convention, and they had to come up with a document. So they left that for further negotiation, but they never did it. So all it says is Congress shall have the power to coin money, and then the 10th Amendment says powers not reserved to or forbidden to the states or reserved to Congress or something like that shall be.
Your powers to the federal government. Everything that isn't specifically authorized by the federal government goes to the states.
The states and the people. So I think it has been argued that the banks means the people. The banks say, well, you all didn't do it, so we're doing it. But anyway, that has to be clarified.
Well, I agree with you. The Constitution really is a mess. It is vagueness all the way through it. We literally need to write a new Constitution, and we really should do it, which we never would, the way they do it in places like Venezuela, Ellen, where they come up with a document, and they let the people vote up or down on whether they want this thing or not. And if they want to change it, again, they just had a constitutional referendum, and the people voted up and down on one change to the Constitution. But the original Constitution was voted on back the end of 1999 under Chavez after he came in. It was a glorious Constitution with all kinds of stuff in it. Ours would fit into one small corner of their Constitution. But they do things like, in it, like guarantee social benefits to the people, Ellen. Can you imagine our Constitution doing something like that? Like free education, free health care, indigenous rights. It goes on and on and on. And people love that document so much that they carry a copy of the Constitution around in a small little pocket-sized a booklet in their pocket. They can pull it out of their pocket and they can talk about the Constitution. I don't think one person in a thousand in this country has ever read ours. And if they did, they probably wouldn't really understand it. Or if they thought they did, they'd be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was actually in Venezuela and they were the sweetest people, very innocent. It was a book fair. I was invited down for a book fair. It was put on by the government to because they wanted to help educate the people. Well, you could arguably, I don't exactly understand this, it's a cruel accounting, but you could arguably work your books so that you put things like education, pension funds, health care on one side of the books as an asset. It's a future asset. And on the other side of the books, you put it as a liability. So you create credit against your future projects. You know, everything. Every loan is monetizing something. When General Motors goes to get a loan, they put everything they've got up. They put their future profits, their buildings, and everything they've got. They pledge against this loan. Well, if you created credit on your books, everybody's afraid this would be inflationary. You can't just print money and throw it out there and expect that that's going to create abundance. But it can create abundance. How you balance your books is you put the thing that you're monetizing on the other side of your books. Well, for instance, education is sort of an intangible. It's not like it's going to pay you money immediately. But you're going to elevate the level of all your people. They're going to make wiser decisions. They're going to use their resources better. They're going to have better paying jobs. They're going to develop better technology. And your health care, maybe education about preventive health care would be part of education. People will start to live better. They won't need as much medical services. They'll reduce the amount that you have to pay for medical. You can put pensions over there because right now the corporations have to pay these pensions, and that's hindering our corporations from competing with other countries that, as a matter of right, provide for pensions.
An education alone, Ellen. The GI Bill after World War II paid for itself many times over. We educated so many people that might never have gotten a college education without it. It was a lot cheaper in those days. My goodness, was it a lot cheaper in those days? Just a pittance of what it costs today. But that was a tremendous investment that pays off. I think national good health is another investment that pays off. And how you do this on a set of accounting books, I don't know. I'm not an accountant, so I certainly don't know how you do it. But Venezuela, I know, is sowing seeds that will repay them in future times. And of course, they're blessed with a lot of oil wealth, even at lower oil prices. But they just decided that they would use the nation's national revenues to benefit the people who never got benefits in the past. And Venezuela has been prospering. The country is also very friendly to business, which you never hear in the U.S. media when they vilify Chavez. But Venezuela is still growing positively. Every country is being hurt by this crisis, but they're still doing pretty well. Even at lower oil prices, they're just not doing what they did a couple of years ago. But if you run things right, it's amazing how well things can go, even in hard times. But you do things the way we do it, and heaven only knows how this is going to turn out. It's really scary, Ellen. I don't know what we're going to face, say, a year from now. How bad will it be then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two possible outcomes. If they keep going the way they are going, it has to end badly. But that's why we have to snatch it out of the fire before it. We don't want it to collapse into a police state because then we won't be able to do anything. We have to do it before that. So I think we need a huge populist movement. I mean, it has to come from the grassroots, because politicians, even if they're well-meaning, they're forced into the system where they have to spend all their time raising money. They have to give pork to their constituents on every single bill. So we have to make some waves from the bottom.
I agree with you 100%. And you hit the nail on the head. And there are already moves afoot that really are laying the foundation of a police state, aside from the laws already on the books, and they're there. But we're setting up troop allocations to be deployed in U.S. streets. We're militarizing local security forces, police, providing them with training, technology, weapons, so on. We're getting ready for civil disturbances to come, because the expectation, I'm sure, is that things are going to get so dire economically, with millions of people out of their homes, out of their jobs, out of their savings, out of their futures, that people will only put up so much and then they'll react. It doesn't mean there'll be bloodshed on the streets by them, but they're going to go out and they're going to kick up a ruckus. And apparently the plan is to meet them with armed force. And it could get very, very ugly. Plus, we're setting up detention camps around the country, so-called FEMA camps, where we can house people. We can just haul them away. You know, the troublemakers, the people who don't have a job and afraid they can't feed their families. We call them troublemakers. We're setting up camps to send these people off to. The militarization of the country is a very, very serious problem.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised when that last time I was in Santa Monica that there are an amazing number of homeless wandering around. There never used to be in that part of town. You know, if you went downtown, there were, but there's definitely more and more homeless, and something has to be done. I mean, it's just appalling that a wealthy nation like ours could let people live on the streets and not have a roof over their heads. But, of course, we don't want FEMA camps. We need some sort of public housing. That's another thing that you could fund with this double entry bookkeeping idea, just the same way banks do all their credit. You could do some low-cost housing. You put that on as an asset on one side of your books. It's going to be income producing, because you'll have them pay something or work it off in some way, and then you put the liability on the other side.
Welcome back. A final brief segment. Ellen, so much more to talk about. You talk about public housing in Chicago. They've been systematically destroying it, as well as destroying the public school system in Chicago. The police are some of the most vicious in the country. It's one reason that George Bush called our mayor Daley his favorite mayor. He's a Democrat. Bush called him his favorite mayor. What can you say? But
yeah, right. Things like the mafia.
Oh well, I think I take the mafia over some of the things that our government does to us.
Yeah. Instead of FEMA camps, what they should be setting up is communal farm type situations. Anyway, there are many things that you could fund if you had the power to issue credit on your books. And it's not like you're just throwing money, like you're just flooding the economy with money. What you're doing is you're monetizing the thing that will pay the loan back in the same way that any bank makes a loan on credit and it gets paid back. So, for instance, alternative energy. You could 50% of the cost of everything is now interest on average, and that was before. It might be worse now. There was a German woman that figured that out, that the cost of anything you buy, 50% of it from the whole chain up of its production is interest. So if you were a government entity that could issue loans interest-free for things that the public needed, for instance, developing alternative energy systems or maybe transportation systems, all those things that we use publicly, if you could build those interest-free, that would cut the cost in half. So these forms of energy that appear not to be productive now, like maybe geothermal or solar, all those that seem like they're too expensive to develop, they're too expensive because half the cost is interest. If you eliminate the interest, they will return the cost and more. In other words, there will be profit generating. So you write that on your books. You create the money on one side of your books. You create the project on the other side of your books, and then you fund the project with the loan from yourself of credit drawn on yourself, you, the government, or your government bank. So as the thing is built and it starts, say it's a train, and people start paying paying for train services, then the money comes back and it pays off the loan. So it's circular. It's not like you're just increasing the money and increasing the money, but you initiate the money. You don't have to have the money before you lend it. You initiate the money. The money is created as the loan, you know, as the asset is envisioned. It's created against the asset, or it's monetizing the asset, and that's where the money comes from.
Wendy Dillon, we're just about out of time, but it's amazing how much good government could do if it really tried instead of doing what it does and causing so much harm. You know, we talk about government all by and for the people. It's never worked that way, even going back to the very beginning, but it's just gotten worse through the years. And now we're, you know, we're right on the edge of the abyss. Heaven knows what we're, mm-hmm. what we're heading into. I think we're in the early stages of this terrible calamity. And so many people will suffer so bitterly as a result of it. And none of it ever should have happened. Nothing at all should have happened. I hope you'll come back and we can do this again. I'll watch for all your new articles, and we'll pick another terrific one and get you back on, Ellen, so we can talk about it and pass more good information on to listeners.
Oh, thank you very much. You're a very good interviewer.
Oh, Ellen, again, it's been a terrific hour. Too short, of course, but this is big stuff, and we'll keep going back and revisiting this often with lots of good people. Come back and join us tomorrow. We will talk about the terrible state of the media, plus the writings of my guest, Peter Phillips, head of Project Censored. It'll be another important hour to listen to. And today we didn't even get to all the money being sucked out for the so-called defense budget, over $1 trillion a year. So many billions of that absolutely down the drain like the rest. We'll talk more about that ahead as well. Join us tomorrow.